Okay, now we are coming towards the yard side of the Rebbe, which will be on the 3rd of Tammuz, which this year is going to be Motzei Shabbat and Sunday. And because of this, I thought that instead of studying a discourse relating to the Parshat HaShavua, the Seder of the Week, which is Chukat, we will look at another discourse that we have actually studied before here, which is the very last discourse that the Rebbe edited. You see, he would say discourses, he would teach discourses in a Hasidic gathering, and the Hasidim would write down the discourses after Shabbat. Usually they were said on Shabbat, sometimes on, you know, the 10th of Shvat, or other times, 12th of Tammuz. They might not be on a Shabbat, but very often they were. And the Chozrim, the Hasidim who could remember the discourse by heart, would write, and the other talks that the Rebbe gave, they would write them down after Shabbat, and every so often they would prepare one for editing for the Rebbe, and the Rebbe would look through it, and he would add and take away and put in footnotes, take out footnotes, change it around a bit, and that was an edited discourse. So it was quite a long process for the Rebbe, an intensive process for him to edit these discourses and teachings. And so there was always seen a great difference between something he'd edited and something he hadn't edited. And here we often take sometimes things which are edited, sometimes things which are not. But this was the very last discourse that the Rebbe edited. It was a discourse he said in 1981, and it was on. It was coming up towards the Purim Katan. There were two Adar that year, 2 months of Adar, and it was coming up to the first Purim Katan, and it was also the Shabbat of Tetzaveh, of the Sedra Tetzaveh. And the discourse that the Rebbe gave about that, he edited in 1992, at the same time in the year, coming up to Purim Katan, and he edited it. And it was published as a tract for Purim Katan 1992, and shortly after this was edited, a couple of weeks later, the Rebbe had a stroke, and he never edited properly anything again, and he never spoke in public after that, and he passed away 2 years later. So although he was...
How much later did he pass away?
In 1994, right. On the 3rd of Tammuz.
2 years later, did you say?
Yeah, 2 years later. Yes, yeah, so during that time that he had the stroke, for a considerable part of that time, he was in the community, like there, you know, at the Tfilot, or certain of the Tfilot, he would come, there was a kind of a balcony in 770, and he would sit on the balcony during the... But he couldn't walk around, and but nonetheless, I mean, there was a sense of contact with the Rebbe during that time. He even organized, or allowed to be organized, yechidut, where people went past the Rebbe. And, you know, there was a sense, I thank God I was one of those at that point, there was a sense of contact with the Rebbe.
Could he talk then?
No.
Couldn't actually talk?
Couldn't talk, no. No, it was a very heavy stroke or series of strokes. And then his health got worse, and he was completely confined to bed, or then he was in hospital, and then he passed away. So this discourse became sort of the final teaching of the Rebbe, following the example of the way he treated the final discourse of the previous Rebbe. Now, Rabbi Yosef Yitzhak, the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, our Rebbe was the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, but his predecessor, in 1950, issued had written a discourse which he issued to be printed, and the day that that was issued for, which was the 10th of Shvat, the Yahrzeit of his grandmother, he himself, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok, passed away, and Rabbi Menachem Mendel, the 7th Rebbe, took that last discourse of Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok as a kind of a last will and testimony, and expounded it a great deal and taught it. In fact, there are two volumes of his teachings about those last discourses. It was really a series of four discourses, 20 chapters in all. And so there's a sense of the same kind of feeling about this discourse, Va'ata Tetzaveh. Because the interesting thing about this discourse, it talks about two crucial themes. One theme is the relationship of a person with a spiritual teacher of the kind that we call a Rebbe, and the individual's relationship with that teacher, and the relationship of that teacher with the entire Jewish people. That there's a particular kind of teacher, that's what comes out in this discourse. There are many different teachers, but there are certain teachers who see the responsibility of the entire Jewish people as being on their shoulders. Now, the Rebbe talks about this in relation to his father-in-law and predecessor, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, and in relation to Mordechai in the Purim story, where you've got the whole Jewish people in the Persian exile, and Mordechai is the one who is dealing with the problem relating to everyone, and he is responsible, as it were, for everyone. And then you have Moshe in the Torah, where you have the whole Jewish people together with Moshe, and Moshe is the one who is responsible for everyone. So that sense of total responsibility, that sense of concern for every single person, and the way that we can understand this in terms of the Rebbe's perspective on the previous Rebbe was the way the previous Rebbe was literally concerned about Jews in all kinds of far-flung places, even though in his own lifetime he wasn't able to do that much about this concern. But it was implemented, even in the lifetime of Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, by Rabbi Menachem Mendel, who ran the organization called Merkoz L'Inyonei Chinuch, Center for Jewish Education, for matters of Jewish education, where he would be sending educational material to countries around the world. Wherever there was a small group of Jews, he would try to communicate with them in some way. And later, when he himself became Rebbe, he began sending his emissaries, shluchim, to those places where 30 years before he'd been writing to people, or somehow been in touch with people. Now he was actually sending an emissary, and they were husband and wife team, and they would set up a Chabad house and things like that. So this sense of concern for the totality of the Jewish people, wherever they are, not just the religious ones, not, you know, every sector. And when you read the Igrot, the letters which are sent to the Rebbe, it's fascinating the variety of people who are communicating with the Rebbe, you know, whether they're Israeli soldiers, you know, officers in the army, or rabbis, or a head of a yeshiva, or another Hasidic Rebbe, or a student in a school, or a girl in a girl's school. It's a fascinating variety of contact and communication, which later one saw very clearly. Things like the Rebbe created this institution of dollars, that people would come and queue up for few hours and come to the Rebbe. The Rebbe would give you a dollar to give in tzedakah. And in that brief interchange, there was a moment of real spiritual contact. A look, a few words, sometimes more than a few words, but there was a tremendous sense of connection. And it was amazing, the variety of people who would come for dollars as well. So that's one aspect of this discourse, the idea of a Rebbe. Now, another aspect of the discourse relates to the Rebbe's teachings all the way through his life, but particularly in the last few years of his life, which is the concept of Mashiach. Now, during the time of the Rebbe's activities, there was a certain sense of outreach. The Rebbe is reaching out to people who don't put on tefillin. He's trying to persuade people to put on tefillin, or other people should go and visit these people and suggest to them they put on tefillin, or they should study Torah, or they should keep kosher. The Rebbe organized a kashrut campaign that if anyone would change over their kitchen, make it kosher, having a kashrut and buying certain things, they would have to buy new crockery. From the Rebbe's office in New York, half the cost, half the expenditure would be supplied. And during the, I think it was the late 70s and the 80s, that was a very common thing, of people kashering their kitchen, and from the Lubavitch office in New York, a sum of money coming to help in that half the cost. Now, a lot of people still kasher their kitchen. I don't think they're getting any money from anywhere, but it sort of that kick-started the whole concept.
Rabbi Futterfast did mine.
Yes. Yeah, I got an email just today or yesterday from someone who was so impressed with Rabbi Futterfast kashering their kitchen and very, very excited about it. Yeah, absolutely. It's a wonderful thing.
It's actually interesting, because if you ask somebody who's, say, just, say, traditional, and they say to you, are you religious? And you say, what do you mean?
Good question.
Over the years, you know, people have heard that conversation. And the thing that most traditional people say is, do you eat kosher?
Mm.
And it's kind of interesting, because I always think that's a weird thing to say. It's not what I would say.
But what would you say?
Well, I would ask, about tefillot and things like that, actually, and spirituality.
All right, very
good. But it's interesting, because it is actually, on the other hand, it is a correct question, because it's a kind of physical manifestation of what's inside, you know. In other words, somebody's actually doing something.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
To concretize it.
You know, it's actually a physical thing.
That is the remarkable thing about Jewish thought, that you have spiritual ideas which come down into a practical reality. Yeah. So the idea of encouraging people to keep Jewish teaching, that characterizes a lot of the Rebbe's activity, together with very spiritual teachings as we explore here, week by week, with the help of God. However, in a sense, the final campaign of the Rebbe was not so much about something practical, but about something spiritual. The concept of yearning for Mashiach. And the idea that is the spinal cord of Judaism. That a person yearns for Mashiach. That they are not content with the situation, the status quo, even if that's a very comfortable status quo. And many people felt that this was, if the other campaigns were addressed to people who didn't yet eat kosher and didn't yet put on tefillin or only studied minimally Torah, here is a campaign that was really addressed to very, very, you know, quote unquote, religious people who are very observant and very knowledgeable, and who were perfectly content because life in a comfortable community like Northwest London, how could one get higher than that? Surely. This is just another version of the Garden of Eden. And there's no higher aspiration possible. And the idea that in a context not of being persecuted. Very often, messianic tension is attributed to a problematic atmosphere surrounding one. That there's danger, You know, so a person manages to deal with the situation through some kind of desperate belief in the Messiah.
Was that the atmosphere around Shabtai Tzvi?
Well, you see, that's the thing. There was a gap that in 1648-9 there were the Khmelnytsky massacres. So 20 years later came Shabtai Tzvi. Mm-hmm. So the idea of a messianic movement then gave a kind of explanation for the persecutions which had taken place 20 years before, from which to a certain extent people were still suffering.
Like a precursor.
So that was one way of understanding it, although there are lots of other ways of understanding it. It was a time of, you know, there are a lot of different ways in which historians analyze that whole process. But the idea that when everything is comfortable, one should not forget that the goal of Jewish teaching is something on a completely different plane. That there should be a temple in Jerusalem, that the Jewish people should be united, that the nations of the world should be united and at one with the Jewish people, and la'ovdo shchem echad, that all nations will serve God together with the Jewish people. Beit Yaakov l'chu v'nelcha, Beit Yaakov, you go, house of Jacob, you go, and we will as well go, say the nations of the world to the house of Jacob. So the Jews keeping the 613 mitzvot and the nations keeping the 7 Noahide laws, a unified world, that image, which could lead then, or will lead then, to spiritual transformation, so that the scorpion will not cause harm. Lo yareyu v'lo yashchitu b'chol hakodshi. There won't be any evil or suffering on my holy mountain. Whether that means only the land of Israel or the whole world, there's different commentators. But there is this messianic idea at the heart of Judaism. Now, Hasidism has often been explained in terms of a kind of internalization of the messianic idea. There is the idea of geula, of redemption, and what is manifested in the earliest form of Hasidism is the quest for geula pratit, personal redemption, private redemption. And that means that someone, through a very deeply spiritual approach to mitzvot and to tefillah, to prayer and to Torah study, seeing the spiritual radiance in the Hebrew letters, whether they are learning or praying, they come to a kind of a spiritual ecstasy, if you like, similar to the time of redemption and the temple. But it's happening within their own world, within their own mind. Like the story, the story which is told of one of the early Hasidic masters, Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, also called Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Horodok. Now, Rabbi Menachem Mendel, in 1777, left Russia and went to live in the land of Israel. And the story is told that at some point, he lived in Tzfat, or maybe Tiberias or something. And so the story is told that it was said that someone had blown a shofar on the Temple Mount, or the sound of a shofar had been heard, and the Messiah was coming. Right? So this would be something like 1780, something like that. So Reb Menachem Mendel is reputed to have gone to the window of his room, opened the window, leaned his head out, and sniffed, and he said, it doesn't smell like the time of the Messiah, so it's a false report. So the question is, why did he have to go to the window of his room? Why couldn't he just sniff in the middle of the room? And the answer is because in his room it did have the aroma, the scent of the time of the Messiah. in order to find out, because he was living as if it was the time of the Messiah, in order to see what the world was like, he had to stick his head out of the window. You know, so the story shows the imagery of the kind of personal geula. Now, is that enough? And one of the second major theme in this discourse is that that's not enough. You have to have a yearning. It's exhorting us to have a yearning for the geula klalit, the general redemption, and that it's through that that will come the general redemption. But also, the focus here is that through yearning for geula and Mashiach, the inner structure of the person is more closely bonded to God, because there is a way in which the yearning for Mashiach somehow encapsulates the whole of the person's life. They are less split into the part of us which wants to daven and the part of us that wants to do other things which may be permitted and so on, you know, but they're just a different world, different atmosphere. And yet here comes the yearning for Mashiach is something all-encompassing within the being of each individual, and therefore helps the whole individual connect with Hashem, and also helps the whole individual connect with every other individual. Because one of the interesting points in this discourse, in terms of the history of Chabad, is that in Rabbi Shneur Zalman's Tanya, there is a discussion about Ahavat Yisrael. How can one achieve real love of one's fellow? And the device, which is presented in Tanya, in chapter 32, which is the central part of Tanya, the lev, the heart of Tanya, is that if you focus on the neshama of another person, then it's much easier to love that neshama. Because the body and the character which goes together with the body, the animal soul, that may well have all kinds of negative, thorny issues which are very difficult to cope with. But if you focus on the neshama, then your neshama feels a link with that neshama, and you can feel the underlying unity between you and that other person. And from the point of view of the neshama, Kol Yisrael Achim, the whole Jewish people are brothers, only the bodies are separate. So that is what it says in Tanya. And it's a workable approach to the idea of Ahavat Yisrael, a very profound approach. Here, it says that through the fact that a person yearns for Mashiach, which manages to totally encapsulate the entire individual, not just their spiritual dimension, but their physical dimension. You see, the difference between Mashiach and other kinds of spirituality is that most forms of spirituality leave the world behind in some way, even if it's just in a temporary way. You make your own little enclave, a beautiful Jewish home. There is this beautiful enclave. The candles are on the table, Shabbat evening. It's this wonderful atmosphere. It's holy. You know, outside somewhere there's a dark or, you know, problematic world. But never mind, because in here it's holy. The concept of Mashiach is that everywhere becomes holy. It becomes universal, it becomes total. And so also with a physical person, that every aspect of the person becomes drawn in to this holiness. Now, apply that to the concept of Ahavat Yisrael. It means, if you're looking with this redemptive perspective at other people, it means, ideally, that one is able to love and feel concern for the other person, not only on the level of their neshama, but also on the level of their body, their activity, the bad jokes they tell and everything else, and the fact they park their car in front of your drive day after day, whatever you try and threaten and control, but it doesn't bother you. Just like a person isn't bothered at a certain level with the things that their own child does, that they love their child, you know, and even though the child has just, I suppose the worst thing that I can imagine the child doing is what happened to a dear friend of ours, her little boy, about 12 years old, reformatted her hard disk and wrapped everything off.
Is he still living at home?
Well, that was some years ago, and but it's, I mean, you know, she suffered a serious it was actually a bit more complicated than that. It had to do with having a Macintosh and but anyway, somehow or other, the whole thing was destroyed. Everything she had was destroyed. I suppose there maybe would still be some technology which could recapture, but she didn't. Anyway, so that's, you know, but a child remains a child, and even if they do something as devastating as that, or God forbid worse, they're still a child, for the most part, you know, let's hope. So that way of seeing other people, that somehow you're able to encompass and connect with the other person on every level. So that is the redemptive level. So those are the two qualities which are in this discourse. The two of the qualities. You know, there are quite a number of other themes that are there, but I would say these are the two major themes. And so that is connection with a Rebbe, with a spiritual teacher, and yearning for Mashiach. And those are the two basic themes. I mean, obviously, in a long discourse like this, there are many other themes, even, you know, central themes, but these are the two key ones. So let's try to explore. Now, and it's based on a verse from the Sedra Tetzaveh. Let's just look at the beginning of this. Va'ata Tetzaveh, so we have it in the Chumash. Va'ata Tetzaveh b'nei Yisrael, you should command the children of Israel, v'yikhu elecho shemen zayit zach, katit leba'or, they should bring to you pure olive oil, beaten for the luminary, for the lamp, lahalot ne tamid, to raise up an eternal light. And that's what God tells Moshe, and va'ata tetzaveh, you should command, the you means Moshe. Moshe's name is not mentioned in this sedra tetzaveh, but when it says you should command, it is talking to Moshe. So let's enter the melody of the discourse, the Maimonides, and hopefully then we'll be able to enter the Maimon itself quickly, because time is short. Ho ye ram bam bam ba ram ba yom ba ho mi ya ye ram ba yam ba yom ha ye ram ba yam ba yom ha ye ram ba ha ye ram ba ho ba ya yam ba yam bam bam ho ya yam ba yam bam bam ho ya ya yom. So we're going to skate through this basic thing. Va'ata tetzaveh b'nei Yisrael, and you should command the children of Israel. V'yikhu elecho shemen zayit zach. So we're now looking at the actual discourse. Michael. Yep. Sorry. Yeah. you should command Bnei Yisrael v'yikhu alech Hashem in Zayit Zach, and they should take for you pure olive oil, katit lama'o lahalot ne'tamid, which is beaten for the light, for the luminary to make an eternal light, v'yiduim hadiyukim v'zen, it's known, the questions asked about this in previous discourses of the leaders of Chabad, v'chol hatzivuim shebetorah, and all the other commands of the Torah, Nehemiah it says, Tzavet b'nei Yisrael v'chayotze bo, command the Jewish people. In other words, command them what God is saying. V'chal ne'emah v'ata t'tzavet b'nei Yisrael. Here it puts it more emphatically focused on Moshe himself. You command the Jewish people. U'lohosif, in further, that the yukma shekatu v'ata t'tzavet, the fact, the question about this phraseology, it's not only the syntax, but it's also the content. What does it mean? The lashon va'ata tetzave mashma, because these words, you command, imply, shemoshe hu ha'matzave, that Moshe is the one who is commanding. V'tzarech la'amin, we have to understand this. Hari Moshe hu ha'shliach, Moshe is the emissary, Limsal Yisrael et Tzivuye HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to give over to the Jewish people the commands of God. V'lama ne'ma v'ata tetzave. Why does it say you should command? So why does it put the whole thing on Moshe in that funny way? Okay, let's skip to the next paragraph. Umavak quote Kedushat Mori B'chom Yad Mor, and the previous Rebbe explains this in a discourse. He said, at the same time of year, in 1927, in Russia, the tzivui, tzave, the word tzivui means tzavta v'chibur, it means connection, it doesn't mean command. What the verse is saying here, you, Moshe, v'zeo, v'ata tzavetz b'nei Yisrael, you, Moshe, connect the Jewish people. Sh'moshe hu mekasher et b'nei Yisrael im oem sof. Moshe connects and binds the Jewish people with the radiance of the infinite. That is what Moshe's role, to connect the Jewish people with God and with this concept of Avat Yisrael that I mentioned earlier. It also means that Moshe is joining the Jewish people to each other. So all this is a function of the relationship with Moshe. So there comes this force of bonding the Jewish people to God. Now comes the question, why should the Jewish people need Moshe to connect them to God? Surely we are the chosen people, we went through many spiritual elements in our history, we have the whole Torah to show for it. Surely we've got our own connection with God. Okay, let's go on to paragraph Gimel. Okay, this is really tasting, wine tasting. Now, paragraph Gimel, that's a good paragraph. And to explain this, Magdim Bamaima, the previous Rebbe explains in his discourse of 1927, as we know, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he's usually commenting on a discourse of one of his predecessors. Shemoshe Rabbeinu Nikra Raya Mehemna. Moses is called the Raya Mehemna, the faithful shepherd. Now, Raya Mehemna is an interesting phrase. It's now the name of a pop group. I think there's a restaurant called Raya Mehemna. Right, these names have not been copyrighted, so... so they exist in all kinds of forms. However, Raya Mehemna is actually a section of the Zohar, which is attributed to Moshe, which was later edited by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And the Raya Mehemna means faithful shepherd, and it means Moshe Rabbeinu himself. Now, if you take these words, Raya Mehemna, faithful shepherd, Raya means Ro'eh Ne'eman, faithful shepherd. But it doesn't come over so clearly in the Hebrew as in the Aramaic. The Shnei Perushim Bezeh, there are two ways of understanding this. One is, Shehu Ro'eh Ne'eman Shel Yisrael. that Moshe is the faithful shepherd of the Jewish people. In other words, he is the shepherd, he is the leader, he cares about the Jewish people, and you can always rely on him to care about them. That's the Ro'eh Ne'eman. But there's another way of understanding the words Raya Mehemna, because of a kind of a looseness in our way of using Aramaic. Raya Mehemna, as if it means pasturing faith. Shehuzan Mufaneset Yisrael, he feeds and supplies Israel Be'inyan Ha'emunah, with faith. So in other words, Moshe is the person who inspires faith in the Jewish people. Now, on one level, that's quite an easy idea to understand. You know, you have a group of people climbing a mountain, and one of them is the Swiss guide. And everyone trusts him. They know that he knows his way around the Alps, and if he says, go here, even though you think this is the craziest thing to do and it'll be very dangerous, look, there's an extra this and that. No, he's the guide, and you know that he is the one who cares about each person, and he's going to get you, hopefully, with the help of God, safe and sound, up and down. So one can understand the idea of a leader helping a person feel a sense of trust. Although here we're not talking about trust in the leader. We're talking about trust in God. We're talking about faith in God. So if you see a person who themselves is someone that you admire and who is a leader in some sense, and that person has great faith in God, so that inspires faith in you yourself. You can understand that you know, well, look, I don't know, but he seems to know, so we'll follow him. And there's a sense in which Jewish leadership, or even, you know, not in very grandiose terms, every kind of spiritual leadership has something of this in it. But here, the discourse takes this in a more subtle way. Because he says that there is a basic belief within people anyway. The faith which is there in the Jewish people on their own back. As the sages tell us, the Jews are, it tells us in Masechet Shabbat, the Jews have faith in God, and they are children of people who have faith in God. There's always this sense of piety not far from the surface. The non-Jewish Jew, who was Isaac Deutscher. So Isaac Deutscher wrote this book, The Non-Jewish Jew, and he describes in the book how he really wanted to do something absolutely un-Jewish. So he went to his father's grave on Yom Kippur with a ham sandwich, and proceeded to eat the ham sandwich. And the non-Jewish reviewer of this book said, what an amazingly Jewish thing to do. You know, his very opposite.
He's so Dafka. Yeah,
that's right.
Could only be Jewish. That's wonderful.
So it's always there. You know, we might try to deny it, but it's there within us. So Yisrael, hey ma'aminim, b'nei ma'aminim. And even if you take a pious Jew, you know, someone who claims to be pious, who is pious, so they have a basic faith, but efshar shetiyeh b'vchinat makif. It's possible that this faith is only superficial. And you have the problem that the Talmud describes, that a thief who is trying to steal, you can have a pious thief who calls on God to help him steal. You know, God, you know, help me. Oh, thank God the police didn't catch me. So you have piety and thievery together. Thieves are not necessarily atheists. You know, to be an atheist, you know, more likely to be, you know, it would need quite a lot of education. You could have educated thieves as well. I'm not trying to suggest that. Thieves have always been denied it here. But the point is that you can have a certain kind of piety and behavior in the exact opposite mode to that which that piety would normally demand. So therefore, piety can be superficial and not really affect the consistent details of the individual's life. And what this discourse is claiming is that that is the force of a Rebbe. That is the power of Moshe Rabbeinu or Mordechai or the previous Rebbe, or for that matter, our Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that he brings the piety that the person has into an inward quality. The fact that Moshe feeds and supplies the Jewish people with faith, who, that means that the faith should be inward, it should be within the person, hafnama, internalized faith, and that somehow the fact that having a Rebbe, having a spiritual teacher who concretizes in his life and in his behavior in a total way this kind of faith and its spiritual and practical effect on the person's life, that makes the entire life of the person express that faith in a way that otherwise it might not do. You know, the faith could be in the prayer book and in the page of Talmud, but when he gets up from the prayer book or the page of Talmud, other forces are there, whereas the effect of a Rebbe is to try to internalize this within the person, that the whole person becomes an expression of this. Now, of course, that is a goal. It's something distant from many people, even if they claim they have a Rebbe, they follow a Rebbe. But it is the direction that the Rebbe is trying to lead the person here. The Rebbe is saying what, the Lubavitcher Rebbe is saying, what is the function of a Rebbe? So the function of a Rebbe is to make a person internalize their faith in God and their sense of connection with God. So, and so then goes on to say that this is not only Moshe in the past, that he is Rai Mahemna, but that is the spreading out of Moshe. The Zohar has this idea of Moshe in every generation, or spreading through the generations, and there was Mordechai in his generation with the Jewish people, and so on. So there is the whole flow of leaders through the generations. Let's just take another little bit of this, and if we can move let's go to a page Lamed Tet at the top of the page, using this new edition. Page Lamed Tet at the top of the page.
Lamed Tet.
Yeah. Right, and we've got. You got that? Right, the bottom paragraph begins Va'inyan Hu. Now, he's got onto the theme that what the Moshe figure triggers off is a sense of dedication to Judaism. And that sense of dedication to Judaism has two modes. One mode is Mesirat Nefesh, self-sacrifice at a time when things are difficult, that there is a relentless attempt to keep Jewish teaching, even though things are very, very difficult, nonetheless the person is going to keep them. And that characterizes a sort of an earlier mode of Jewish life, a pre-modern, if you like, although it's also a feature of the life of the Hasidim of Lubavitch in the Soviet Union, where they struggled very hard to maintain some kind of sense of Jewish identity, and other people in very difficult situations. But the second mode, which this Moshe figure triggers off, is in a time of plenty, when you have everything. Not only you have everything physical, you have everything spiritual as well. You have wonderful libraries and synagogues and an Eruv and all kinds of spiritual positive things around you, and nonetheless the person feels a sense of yearning and longing for Mashiach. And that is also triggered off by this teacher, by this Moshe Rabbeinu, because the Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't want the person just to be satisfied with the here and now. He wants us to get to the promised land. That's the whole thrust of Moshe Rabbeinu. Va'inyan hu. Now the matter is, the Zeshi Yisraelim Shvurim, the fact that the Jewish people feel broken, Mizeh Shehem Begalut, from the fact that they're in exile, Gam kashiyesh lahem achava b'gashmiut uberuchniyut. Even when they have plenty, they have everything they want, both materially and spiritually. Who? The reason is ki rotzono ha'amiti shel kol echad miYisrael, the true desire of every single Jew, who sheyiyeh gilui elokut, is that Godliness should be revealed. Va'ad shezeh nogeh le'etzem metziuto, and this really bothers the person. And so therefore, Zesh Bizmana Galut, the fact that in the time of exile now, Ein Meya Gilu Elokut Kumosha Hayaba Beta Mikdash, the revelation of godliness is not there as much as it was in the time of the temple, Mr. Brackens. He named Atzmo, from this itself is there in Gansen zu Treselt, he's completely shattered. Katit, he's so in other words, it really bothers him that godliness is hidden, even though he's got a synagogue and he's got a Beit HaMedrash and he's got a library and he's able to keep Shabbat and he can put on tefillin and he can do this, and there's a kosher restaurant, kosher Chinese restaurants, kosher Thai restaurants. What more could a person want? And even when he's on an even higher level, Shemeya etzlo gilui. Okay, this is page mem. Next page. For this person, godliness shines gilui lekud, butugmat hagilui shahay bezman abayim, like the revelation there was in the time of the temple. For this individual, it's as if the temple's still there. He is really the apex of the whole concept of what Hasidism is about.
It's like the one you mentioned before.
Yeah.
The rabbi who went to the window.
That's right. Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Horotog, he had to go to the window because inside his room there was the atmosphere of the temple of Mashiach. Mikol makom, nonetheless, mizeh shebeklaluto olam, from the fact that in the world in general, ein meya hagilui, the revelation doesn't shine, Muchach, that proves shegama gilui shemayi etzlo, that revelation that shines for him personally, hu gilu mugbal, is a limited revelation. Because this is a very interesting concept. Because when the real radiance of the infinite shines, this unlimited radiance, then hagilu hu b'chol makom. Then the revelation is everywhere. If anywhere in existence there shines the absolute infinity of godliness, then that can't be contained into just one spot. It must shine everywhere. And so therefore, ukashiyesh lemakom echad, and if there's one place, afilu pinani dachat, even a remote corner of the world, Shein meya sham gilu elokut, where godliness doesn't shine, isn't revealed, humipnesha hagilu, it's because that place where it is revealed, hu gilui mugbal, is only limited. So therefore you cannot satisfy yourself. This is what the Rebbe is saying to the generation who after the Holocaust have rebuilt Judaism, and it's absolutely wonderful, and their yeshivot, and there's yeshivot in Israel, and it's a most wonderful atmosphere. But nonetheless, there are places where there is not awareness of godliness, whether among the Jewish people or for that matter among the non-Jewish people. And in that case, that means that the gilui, which is there at the place where you think it is limited. And so therefore the person is concerned that there should be Mashiach, and he and she have a tremendous yearning for Mashiach, and that is something which is all-encompassing, and it encompasses all the different aspects of the person. And on page Membet, if we move a couple of pages on, nearly to the end, penultimate page, there's a paragraph there in brackets, Ulahair, and just to point out, Shal Yedezen Itosef Gamba Achdut Yisrael, this also increases the unity of the Jewish people. Sha'achdut Yisrael, because the unity of the Jewish people, Al Yedei Etzem and Neshama Shemitgalet Mahem, through their, see, there is the Neshama, which is there in the person, and that is revealed at certain times of stress. But that is kamod davar nosaf ha-metziyotam. In a sense, that's separate to what they really are as a normal person. So when a person has mesirut nefesh, it's very valiant. You know, they act as a hero, and it's tremendous. But it's in a special, heightened spirit of, you know, you got to face up to Stalin or to whatever it is. Whereas what the Rebbe is trying to achieve is a different dimension, which is the total personality. And so he links that Mesirut Nefesh with V'lechein Achdut Zu, this unity, while Yedei She'osim Nafsham Ika V'Gufam Tafel. This is what Tanya says is the key to Ahavat Yisrael, making one's soul the main thing and the body secondary. But Al Yedei Gilui Etzem and Neshama Kamoshi Mushreshet Ba'atzmut, through revealing the essence of the soul as it's rooted in the essence of God, which is the effect of yearning for Mashiach. Shal Yedei Ze Gam Atziyot Do Kochot HaGluyim Huchadim HaEtzem, which means an encompassing quality that every aspect of the person radiates with some spiritual quality. Ha'achdut Yisrael b'chol inyanim shalehem, the unity of the Jewish people is in every aspect, gam b'inyanim ha'shayachim laguf, even matters which relate just to the body. And so therefore that is the purpose of the Jewish people, and the whole task, if we go to the very last page, so this is the task of the Moshe Shebedareinu, the Moshe in our generation, whom he's speaking of as the previous Lubavitch Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak. And if we just look at the top line on the last page, Avodato Le'orer Le'galot, his task is to arouse and reveal et emunah shebechol echad miYisrael, the faith in every single Jew, Shemitzad Etzim and Hashama, from the essence of the Neshama in its deepest way, but often in such a manner, Sha'achakach Ya'avdu Avodatam B'Koach Atzmam, that afterwards they will do their service with their own power. Now that's a very interesting thing, that the function of a Rebbe is to illuminate people, to connect them together with God and to each other, with this power, with the power on the one hand of self-sacrifice for keeping of Judaism in difficult times, and secondly, which might also be in the personal life of an individual now as well, but to face up to the challenge, but also to have, when everything is easy, as well, to yearn for Mashiach, to yearn for the totality. And this transforms the person, and the goal is that the person should have these qualities on his own or on her own. Va'ad shiyuneh tamid she'ein shaykh bo shinui, till one becomes an eternal lamp, gam mitzad kochot ha-giluyim, also as regards the external qualities of the person. Va'ad yedei zeh, finally, va'ad yedei zeh, and through this, zochim b'karov mamash, we will soon merits the gula mitit vashlema, the true and complete redemption. Then there will be gilul lekut gam mitzad amata, and then godliness will be revealed not only from above but from the service of the person here below, and that will be in the Beit HaMikdash HaShlishi, in the third temple, with the Gula Amitit Vashleima Al Yidei Mashiach Tzedkenu, with the true and complete redemption through Mashiach, with Karov Mamash, swiftly indeed. So that is the Atat Tetzaveh Maimah, this discourse, which will be studied around the world on Saturday night and Sunday, which is the Yotzeit of the Rebbe.